I'm Michelle, and in case you detect an accent to save you that question that people go, are you Canadian? Because they're afraid to offend the Canadians, but really think I'm American. Yes, I'm American. I'm from Florida, but as of 2 weeks ago, I am a British citizen, so watch out. Here I come. It's great to be here, and I work with Michael, who was here this morning, if you were here this morning, for an organization called RZAM, and we just get to go around the world, really, why we believe, why we do, and help those who maybe have questions about the Christian faith engage in a different way and try to clear away some of the biggest barriers and say, you know, you can think and believe in God. It's quite a great opportunity. But tonight, kind of on that whole topic, I want to ask you a question. Why should God get the final word? And that's what we're going to be engaging with tonight. Why should God get the final word? Now, either if you are a person of faith tonight, if you are a Christian, and you've been asked things like, why do you live the way you do? Why do you do the way you do? Why do you believe what you do? Why do you live, think, act, feel that way? Maybe your first response is, well, because God tells me to do so, or because Jesus did it, or because God. And if you might not be a Christian here tonight, maybe you've thought, well, why is that a good reason? Why do you do things just because God tells you to do things? Isn't that a bit robotic? Isn't that a bit antiquated? Why? Why should God get the final word? Why is pain or suffering or different random things that don't seem to go with science okay just because the Bible tells you so and just because God says so? But before we fully engage with that particular question tonight, I just want us to think about this whole idea of finality first. What do you think of when you hear the word final? Maybe you think of the final episode of your favorite show and you're so sad that Friends isn't on anymore. Or maybe you think of the final version of a project or a dissertation you were slaving away on, and that's it, it's final, it's over. Maybe you think of your lovely husband or as a parent to your child going, this is the final time I am going to repeat myself. Not one more time. Or maybe you finally got seen by the doctor after waiting in that stupid waiting room for 2 hours for your appointment. Maybe it's a final goodbye. Whatever it is, the whole idea of something final, the issue of finality, usually doesn't conjure up happy thoughts for us. We don't tend to like finality much in life, and often we fight it. And, you know, given the advancement that we've had in technology, forget about the last century. Let's think the last couple of decades, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and pair that with the whole ideas of postmodernity that have trickled down, that we're tolerant of everything and anything goes kind of culture. You could make an argument that in our cultural moment, we not only have fought finality, but maybe we have conquered it or won some of the battles more than any other time in history. Think about it. You can literally cross the globe in hours. My father-in-law came to Cambridge for university. My husband and I were at Oxford, so we wore about that a little bit. But when my father-in-law went from the States to Cambridge, he took a boat. There weren't flights you could get on. Yeah, he took a boat. I go back and forth from when I was a student. We travel around the globe with what we do. At the touch of a button, long live Skype, you can talk to anyone at any time for free now. Because of internet social networking, we have cut across barriers of race, gender, culture, globalization, governments, that people 50 years ago said, we'll never be able to talk to them, we'll never be able to meet them, we'll never be able to understand that culture. So, the whole concept of something final has come to just mean old, outdated. We don't really even believe that anything can truly be final anymore. Why? Because right when the final course is announced of your final module of your degree, right when the final episode is aired of something or the final version of software or a product comes up, we sit up a little bit because we think, ooh, what's next to be released. Something final happened, but that means the next thing I need more. It's going to be better. So not only do we not get it, but we don't really believe in it anymore. But if you start to suggest that as a Christian, you've come to know an ultimate truth, that there could be such a thing as ultimate or final morality or laws set by an ultimate moral lawgiver, namely God, suddenly people's hearts beat a little faster, pulses quicken. The whole idea and issue of finality is no longer irrelevant, it's important. It gets people a little bit hot under the collar. Nobody can say the final word in my life except for me. The final thing is that there is no final thing. And why is it suddenly so important when we talk about faith, when we talk about morals, when we talk about truth? Well, this is what Wikipedia has to say of why the final word is so important. Getting the last word means that you win the debate. It also shows your moral superiority and willingness to stand your ground. This should convince your opponent that you are correct, and it will certainly impress your fellow Wikipedians. I mean, that says enough about finality, about truth there. Getting the final word suddenly means something if it's about winning. If it's about authority, even though it didn't mean anything for all those other things in life. So what gives someone authority? What gives someone authority in a debate, in truth, in morality, in government, in ethics? Maybe a closer question for you tonight. Who has the final word in your life? Why should God get it? If you say God willingly, why? Why does he have it? And if you say, I have the final word, why maybe should God have it instead of you? You might say, well, every religion claims finality, even if it's just the claim that there is no finality. Why should God of Christianity, why should this one religion, why should the way Christians believe be any more authority than any other way of thinking? Well, here's where we're going to turn to the Bible tonight. And for the rest of the time, we're going to pick apart this few verses in Numbers. Yes, I did say Numbers. That is in the Old Testament. That is in the first part of the Bible. Numbers 23, verses 18 through 21. I'm just going to read out a few of these. Numbers 23, 18 through 21. And now, just a quick setting of this. Basically, this little passage comes in a time where someone is hoping that God will change his mind about his people. And this is what the answer is. God is not a man that he should lie, nor the son of man that he should change his mind. Does he speak and not act? Does he promise and not fulfill? I have received a command to bless. He has blessed. I cannot change it. The Lord their God is with them. The shout of the king is among them. So let's look at that question again. Why should God get the final word? Well, first of all, God gets the final word because he is first. That's what gives him the authority. We see this in verse 19, the first part. God is not a man that he should lie, nor the son of man. Most of our problems with God, most of our barriers to belief, most of our doubts and complaints against him stem from the fact that we try to understand God by comparing him to ourselves. We try to understand God by comparing him to any other relationship, even the best relationship that we've had in life. And we have wrong expectations or fears about how he has acted, how he should act, how he will act or answer, because we think, if I were God, I would have done things that way. Why didn't he act that way? Or we think, everyone else in life has treated me this way when I have done that. God's going to do the same thing. Now, where do we get that understanding from? Well, Genesis 1:26 says this, "Let us make human beings in our own image, making them reflecting our nature." This is God talking about creating you and I, creating humanity. We're made in the image of God. Now, being made in the image of God is what gives human beings significance over everything else in creation. But we must not confuse significance with equality. We must not confuse significance, the fact that we're made in the image of God, and that means so much of our worth, our value, our destiny, our origins, but we can't confuse significance with equality with God. Just because we're made reflecting the image of God and his nature doesn't mean that we are exactly like God. Voltaire put it this way: God made us in his image, and then we returned the favor. And that's where a lot of our doubts stem from. That's where a lot of our barriers stem from. We start to compare the Creator with our created nature instead of letting our similarities point us back to him. Think of it this way. We are the Polaroid. We are the snapshot of the amazing view. We are the painting, and the painting can be amazing and breathtaking and beautiful, but the painting is of the original source. We are not the true subjects. We are just the objects capturing the eternal subject. One commentary puts it this way: behind all visible created objects, giving them all their reality, lies the unchangeable God. Creatures are what they are made or grow to be. They are what they were not. They are what they will sometime not anymore be. But he is what he is. Lifted above time and change, self-existing and self-determined, he is the fountain of life, the same forever. That's why the first words in the Bible are, "In the beginning, God." If you haven't noticed or thought about this before, this is an intentional theological statement. It wasn't just because Moses, or whoever you think the author was, didn't know how to start, so we thought, okay, let's start with God. In the beginning, God. In the beginning, God. It's talking about his preeminence. It's saying he is first. He is the only authentic original. He's the only uncreated one. He is the Logos, the first word by which all else has meaning, the first subject by which all other objects are modeled on. And most of us fail to even scratch the surface of the significance of this concept that God is first. What does it mean that God is first? Well, first of all, because he is first, he is before time. He is eternal. Why do we talk about God being eternal? Because he was first. If God is before time, then time cannot change him. That's why it says in the Bible he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Though he is the Ancient of Days, he never gets any older. Think about this. He is no older now than he was millions of years ago, nor will be in millions of ages to come. His eternity is an everlasting, unchangeable now. His eternity is an everlasting, unchangeable now. So because he's first, he is before time. He's eternal. What else does him being first mean? Because he is first, it means he is outside of space. What does that mean for us? It means he's everywhere. If he came before space was, before the universe was created, then that means he's bigger than it. Infinitely immense, if you will. He fills heaven and earth with his presence, which means he is omnipresent. He is everywhere. He can't and doesn't move from point A to point B. And because of this, this firstness, this preeminence, that is why he has authority. His preeminence is his authority. God gets the final word because he is first. And since he came before everything, what does he have the authority on? Everything. On morality, on truth, on ethics. This is what gives God the authority, and why his authority stretches to everything. So God gets the final word because he is first. Secondly, God gets the final word because he never changes his mind. Let's look at verse 19, the second half, and into 20. God is not a son of man that he should change his mind. Does he speak and then not act? Does he promise and not fulfill? I have received a command to bless. He has blessed, and I cannot change it. one of the main reasons that God is altogether different from us is that he is unchangeable. In Malachi 3:6, it says, I am the Lord, I change not. Now, in theology and philosophy, we understand this whole idea of being unchangeable as something known as immutability. That's a new word for you tonight, but probably not. You're all very intellectual. Immutability. What does this have anything to do with this issue of why God should get the final word in your life and my life? Well, because he is unchangeable, first of all, he is perfect. Because he is unchangeable, he is perfect. Let's unpack that a little bit, because naturally our minds don't go there. What? He's unchangeable, he's perfect, how do you figure? Well, it was Plato who first argued that since God is unchangeable, God has to be perfect. Why is that? Well, because if he changes, it has to be either for the better or for the worse. Now let's think through this. If he changes for the better, then at some point he wasn't perfect, so he couldn't have been God. And if he changes for the worse, then he goes from being perfect to suddenly being imperfect and then no longer is God. So it follows that we assert that God is good, God is wise, God is just, holy, righteous, pure. You fill in all of those great things that we like to say about God. Why are we confident of this? Why can we say these things? Because he never changes, because he is perfect. The Bible describes the God of Christianity as glorious in holiness. His perfection never tarnishes. It can never be sullied. It is always illustriously the same. There's no unrighteousness in God. And because he's unchangeable, he can't go from righteous to unrighteous. He can't go from just to unjust. This is why Christians can be and should be confident that he is the ultimate righteous judge, that neither can nor will do iniquity, that he is unchangeably good, unchangeably happy, and eternally perfect in all he does. Now, when you thought about God last, when was the last time you thought, my God is unchangeably happy? Or if you haven't thought about God in a positive light before, maybe you've gotten the wrong thought about him after talking to, did you know that God is unchangeably happy? So because he's unchangeable, he's perfect. Because he's unchangeable, he's also omniscient or all-knowing. His unchangeable perfection also means that he is unchangeable in knowledge. His understanding is infinite. It can never decrease and nothing can ever increase it. Now let's take a little moment to think about this, because this is completely foreign to us. We just can't get our heads around it. The nature of humanity is we are born. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter called Sophia, and she did not come out knowing everything. In fact, she was pretty reliant on me because she didn't even know how to hold her head up yet. Okay? Our knowledge gradually increases. That's just what happens in humanity with age, experience, the gathering of information. And in fact, the entire critical studies movement in academia means that we're always expecting new interpretations of data to come out. History, old documents, new scientific reports, even science. Most scientists say nothing is ever truly proven because there could always be new findings. From the very beginning of school, we get put in, you're never too old to learn something. There's never a stupid question. And because of this, this is one of the main reasons we don't really understand God, or we doubt him, or we have problems with his authority and his justice. But wrap your head around this. God knows no more now than he did from all eternity. He knew as much then as he does now. Now, if you start to link up all these divine attributes that I've been talking about, that he's before time, he's outside of space, he's perfect, he knows everything, then you start thinking that he knows and sees and understands all things perfectly together and at once in his vast eternal mind. God doesn't experience life the way we experience it. It's not one moment after another moment, one experience after another thing. All things, past, present, and future, come together and are beheld by him in one view. This is why he never changes his mind. He doesn't need to. God never changes his mind because he doesn't need to. So what are we saying about the God of Christianity? The God of Christianity is preeminent and perfect. What other qualifying attributes would you like to demand for someone having the authority on what is final in life? Have the authority and the last word in life. You might be thinking, well, see, this is where your argument breaks down. Because actually, I know a lot of old people out there that have a lot of experience, but that still really doesn't classify them to speak. And actually, I know a lot of people that are pretty all-powerful, that have a lot of authority, but throw it around and are kind of mean with it. That doesn't necessarily mean just because you've got all the experience in the world, and just because you've been there and you know it all, does that really mean you should get all of the authority? And this is the final reason tonight why God gets the final word. God gets the final word because the final word is love. Let's look at verse 21. The Lord their God is with them. The shout of the king is among them. The most amazing part about the Christian faith is this eternal, all-powerful, perfect, all-knowing God, an altogether different God, is a God of love. A God of love and relationship. And he has made the ultimate, unchangeable promise of love to you and to me. God is love. That is what it says in the Bible. And since God is unchanging in who he is, it means he is unchanging in love. Just like what we talked about, his love neither increases nor decreases because it's the gift of God himself given in everlasting covenant to us. One of the names of God is what? Emmanuel. God with us. That's what this verse 21 says. The Lord, their God, is with them. From the very beginning of Scripture, the story told to us is of this incredible creator, God of love and relationship, that promises his loyal love and relationship to his creation. Where do we find this in Scripture? Genesis 17:7. I will establish my covenant as an everlasting covenant between me and you and your descendants after you for generations to come. I will be your God and the God of your descendants after you. In other words, I am yours. God is saying, I am for you. Jeremiah 31:3, the Lord appeared to us in the past saying, I have loved you with an everlasting love. I have drawn you with loving kindness. Psalm 145:13, the Lord is faithful to all of his promises and loving towards all he has made. There have never been any stops or impediments to his love. Not the fall of Adam, not the sad effects of sin in our world and in our lives because of it. Even when you sin, if sin's too big of a word, even when you mess up and do the things you know seem to be the least godly in the world, even if you reject him, if you curse him, in all of our backsliding, he still loves us freely and never alters his covenant and offer of love to us. It gets even better. None of our failures or sins even make him think or so much consider changing his mind about us. You're like, I don't know about that. I think you're preaching something a little bit weird. I'm going to have to talk to the pastor later. But that's what the Bible says when it says there is no shadow of turning with him. James 1, Job 23, exactly the same thing. Twice that is said. But the thing is, we don't understand love like this. We don't understand relationship like this. We don't understand commitment like this. In fact, you couldn't get more from humanity than what I've just been describing. Because even the most committed, devoted, trustworthy, level-headed people in our lives, and I'm not one of them, I'm Italian-American, I'm the most changeable that you can probably get. Even the most committed and loving people and relationships have at least wondered or thought at some point, what have I gotten myself into? Man, this is hard. Why in the world? Maybe, oh, really? Really? Can I forgive one more time? What? But God, there's no shadow of turning with him. We are confident that he has never once rethought his promise of love and relationship to us because he knows and he has always known and will always know everything. Remember all those attributes we were talking about? God knew Adam would fall. God knew that from birth we would all fall short, but this never hindered his love towards us, his choice of us, his covenant with us. Hebrews 6:18 in the Message version puts it this way: God can't break his word, and because his word cannot change, the promise is likewise unchangeable. We who have run for our very lives to God have every reason to grab the hope promised with both hands and never let go. And as Christians, that's why we don't and we shouldn't begrudgingly let God have the final say in our lives. Let God have the final say on truth, on morality, or even in eternity. Because we live in fear of some scary, eternal, know-it-all God who's going to punish us, who's always there about to change his mind depending on how we performed or not. That's not the gospel. That's not the message of hope that we believe in. That's not the hope and the love that we cling to and run to. No, as this passage says in Hebrews, we run for our very lives to God because we've heard the good news that God is for us. God is for us. And I just want to repeat that. And I love that Steve got up and said that in the middle of worship. And maybe if you're not used to a church service quite like this, or maybe as you heard that, you thought, really? Because the things in my life recently don't really seem like God has been for me. Why the shout of the king is among them, as it says in Numbers 23, and why a lot of you guys started shouting when Steve said, if God is for us, who can be against us, is because we realize that the God of perfect love, who will never and can never change his mind, is for us. That's amazing. And this is the reason for our hope. This is the reason for our confidence in faith. This is why it might seem that some Christians are overly joyful, happy clappy, if you will, why the shout of the king is among us, because God is for us. And you think, well, how can you be sure of that? Because exactly what that passage said right after that was read out. If God is for us, who can be against us? Why? Because if he didn't even spare his own son to love us, that's how we know. We know that God is for us even when we're broken, even when suffering comes, even when we don't understand where God is at. Why? Because God came to us. And this is precisely what sets the Christian faith apart from all other religions and all other worldviews. This is the authority. This is the evidence. This is the proof of our faith that God, through Jesus, has the final word in all things. John 1:14 says this: the word, the first and the last word, became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. You see, the constant fluctuation of our own morality, our own views, our own opinions on life, on love, on ethics, as well as every other human authority in history, shows our need for a firm, unchangeable, ultimate, objective standard to live by. That we need something and someone external to our ever-changing selves. And you know what? My first degree was in politics. That's the start of every good political philosophy. It's the state of nature. It's that perfect dream behind all governments. It's the heartbeat of every fairy tale kingdom. Deep inside, we long for a kingdom, a government, or at least some trustworthy authority that will provide the perfect parameters for the best life. The good news of the gospel is that this kingdom has been established, that we have been given an unchangeable standard to live by through the life and character of Jesus. This means that his truth is the only truth. His judgments, decrees, and promises are forever fulfilled. And through his life, we read the perfect law of love, the perfect law of truth, and the perfect law of morality. And by our deflections from it, then we measure our guilt. And you think, ah, that's the problem. That's why I don't stand up and shout when you talk about Jesus. That's why this whole idea of God having the final word and God even being real isn't something happy for me. It doesn't make me want to dance and worship. It actually makes me want to run and hide or stand up and fight or possibly just give up in depression. I could never live up to his morality. His perfection is too much. His standards are unattainable. The utopian kingdom, the dream of the king, Jesus of love sounds great, but I don't perform that way. It's unreachable. His standard is unreasonable. Have you ever felt that sense of guilt or pressure of unreachable perfection? It's a big issue for a lot of people. In fact, it's what many theologians say, and it's why they say that sin is infinite. Maybe you felt that before, thinking about sin. It just seems like it's always there. You just get out of one, and it's right there. Sin is infinite. Why? Because all sin is against God. If he's infinitely good, pure, holy, right, then it follows that we're going to be what? Infinitely bad, impure, unholy, always in the wrong. And the truth is, most of us just don't like to be wrong. Forget about a little bit of the time, not all of the time. We just don't like to be wrong. We are finite beings committing sin against an infinite being who requires infinite satisfaction that we can never give. How is that fair? Why would I want to give a God like that the final say in my life? But for a man called Kierkegaard, it's exactly this revelation that sets him free to run confidently into the arms of an unchanging God. This is what he says: I will love God because he gives everything to the one who loves. He fulfills my highest, my only wish, that in relation to him, I must always be in the wrong. Never will any alarming doubt ever tear me away from him. Never will the thought terrify me that I could prove to be in the right in relation to him. Why? Because that means that he isn't powerful, that he isn't God, that he isn't perfect, that he isn't unchangeable. In relationship to God, we will always be in the wrong, no matter how hard we try. We have to be for him to be God. But in this revelation, there is so much freedom. There's so much joy because that's the gospel. Even though we're always in the wrong, the Lamb was slain before the creation of the world, says in Revelation 13. Romans 5:8 says this, but God demonstrates his love for us in this, what? While we were still sinners. The gospel isn't behave right and then you belong, change and then God will love you. The gospel is this, while you're still messed up and while you're in the process of messing up still, I come to you. I love you. The Lamb was slain. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And you see, it doesn't matter whether tonight you ever choose to let God have the final say in your life because of who he is, because he came first before all things, because he's perfect, because he's never changing in his covenant of love towards you, he already has the final word. Actually, it's not for you to give him the authority. So whether you ever realize that or not, he already has the final word, and the final word is love. The final word is, I am yours. You can have this. It doesn't matter that you've pushed me away, because you know what? Then I sent Jesus to say, you can come back again. The final word is love. God is love, has always been, and will always be. It's why we were created out of the overflow of his love to share in relationship, in joy, in perfect love with him. It's why Jesus came. To underline again the depths of his love. The final word will always be love, but you have to decide to accept it or to reject it. Why should God get the final word? He has it. He's first. He came before. He is the first word, and he never changes his mind. And the good news is the final word is love, but just like any invitation into relationship. When Peter asked me to marry him, I had an option. He asked me, I could say no. That was an answer. I could say, you know what? I didn't really realize you loved me that much. I really need to think about this a little bit more. I need to think about the cost. I need to think about how much it's going to change my life. I need to think about what it's going to mean to be in relationship. Give me some time to think. Or you can say yes. The offer of love is there. The final word will always be love. But you have to react to it. You have to react to it. This is the gospel. This is why God gets the final word. I just want to invite the band to come back up, if that's okay. And maybe we could all stand. Is that all right? And just before we get moving around too much and before we move on, I just wonder, what are the words that have been spoken over your life? What are the relationships that have been broken because of words that have been harsh, because of promises that have been broken? What are the things in life that have caused you to question God's love towards you, to define how much you are loved by how you have performed? I wonder if anyone here tonight might just want to run afresh to the love of God, might want to say, I want your final word over my life more than anything else. I want to say yes. I want to say yes.